There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Candidate Confessional. I am Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
Now, Jason, oftentimes early on in a campaign, before a candidate has uttered his first soundbite, kissed his first baby, his resume will give us an inflated sense of how he'll do in a race.
Tim Pawlenty was just one of those candidates.
Correct. On paper, Pawlenty seemed perfect. He's a Republican governor from Minnesota. It's an on-again, off-again swing state. He's a fiscal conservative who could relate to working-class voters. He was, as he liked to claim, a Sam's Club Republican.
I'm not even sure what that means.
I have no idea what
that means. But he was everyone's favorite runner-up for Veep.
That's correct. Now, Pawlenty, or Teapot as he became known, also had, he had a mild personality.
Minnesota nice.
Exactly. And in a normal election cycle, this actually might be a good thing. But when he launched his campaign for the presidency in 2011, it quickly became apparent that his party wanted more than just a sterling resume. They wanted a little fire, a little fight.
And it became clear he could not provide that fight at all.
So Pawlenty's interview with Candidate Confessional is, in essence, a story about how hard it is to sell being no thrills and competent at a time when people just wanted pure, bloody red meat.
Beyond the bluster.
Behind the bunting.
Past the posters.
After the ads.
The campaign picks up.
And the motorcade moves on.
What happens when the votes are counted?
And democracy doesn't go your way.
This is Candidate Confessional, a HuffPost podcast.
I'm Sam Stein. Okay. I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And we approve this podcast. We want to start actually in the time where you do not get the VP pick from Senator McCain, 2008. What are the mental preparations after that, between that point and when you decide to run for president? I mean, everyone talks about, you know, the process of figuring out that you want to run, but how early does it actually really start, that type of thinking?
You think about these things in retrospect as one big grand arc, but in the moment, it evolves iteratively. So, you know, you think there was some grand strategy at a certain magical point in time, and in the way you live your life, Sam, you'd have a roadmap, milestones, you know, checkboxes.
Naturally.
Yeah. But I think it evolves actually a little more incrementally than that. And in my case, it was, hey, look, I think I could do this. Do I have the skills? Do I have something to bring to the table? Do you got the requisite experience? You got a good message?
Was there like a critical conversation you had with your family that was a turning point?
You know, everybody always, I think, thinks, well, there's that magical Thanksgiving dinner where the family, you know, you carve the turkey and then the family,
your
extended
really
family gathers and you deeply discuss it and then, you know, there's a vote taken. And,
sounds like the worst Thanksgiving
of all time. There's always some, you know, 5-year-old kid or grandkid who comes in with some thing that, you know, becomes a part of a speech later on or something. For us, I think it happened much more it evolved over months. There wasn't like a magical family, you know, summit in our, you know, mountaintop retreat.
Gotcha.
Or something.
Gotcha. But in those first strategy sessions, when it became clear that you were going to do this, you were launching a PAC, and your advisors come up to you, they say, okay, you got to do this or this better, or you have to, this is where your weaknesses are, and this is how you have to fix them. What were they pinpointing?
You know, for us, one of the things was, you know, everybody gets a label very quickly. You know, you got to fill it in 3 words. So, you know, Huckabee's the, you know, as an example, he's the funny guy preacher. Mm-hmm. You know, I forget who was running last time. You know,
You were running last time.
Yeah. You know, Ron Paul was the, you know, kind libertarian. Of constructively eccentric libertarian.
That's, and, you
know,
that's very kind.
So you could kind of just label everybody three words, sure. and that becomes the narrative, and either live or die by it, you know, unfortunately. And it's hard to reverse once it gets stuck. And so, you know, being a successful two-term governor with a blue-collar background from a Midwestern state.
It's not three words.
That's not three words. So, you know, you got to come up with the quote-unquote brand, the narrative, sure. instantly. And I think we struggled with that.
Where do you think you were most would have been most comfortable, the policy side or the sort of firebrand whatever side?
Well, I like to think I could have done both, but I think probably naturally I skewed towards the policy end of it. But, you know, the reality of it is if you want to convince party activists, you know, they're not interested in page 7 of your white paper on healthcare reform. They want to know if you're going to, you know, bash Obama. Or,
did you try that out? Were there times?
Yeah, we did. And I think we had a pretty good response, but for whatever reason, we moved away from that, I think, to a slightly different place on the continuum.
Where was that place, though?
I think it was trying to be more of, you know, if you look at our, again, my campaign was very brief, so it's not like we, you know, recalibrated this 10 times over a year and a half. We had, you know, the whole campaign lasted like 10 minutes. So it was more
brief than that. We're talking about the first minute.
More brief than that. But, you know, our thing in the announcement with otherwise was, look, we're just going to go tell the truth. We're going to go down to Iowa. We're going to say that the time for ethanol subsidies, as an example, is going to have to wind down. We went down to Florida and gave a speech about telling the truth about entitlements in things like Medicaid and Medicare and retirement ages and eligibilities. You know, we went to New York and said we're going to tell the truth about Wall Street and, you know, getting out of bailouts and the rest, and on down the list. So the theme, the kind of organizing theme around the campaign was the party in the country would appreciate, you know, somebody who's got the policy chops to back it up but could deliver a truth-telling message. But it was serious. It was it wasn't designed to be entertaining. It was designed to kind of evoke a serious policy discussion. And, you know, I think that's – we had to do it over again, probably had to make it more entertaining.
It's hard to talk about the campaign without talking about the debate in Obamacare.
President Obama is the person who I quoted in saying he looked to Massachusetts for designing his program. He's the one who said it's a blueprint and that he merged the two programs. And so using the term Obamacare was a reflection of the president's comments that he designed Obamacare on the Massachusetts health care plan.
Tell us how that concept of that phrase came about.
Well, I believe I thought it up. I used it. Yeah, I mean, I think the way it came about is I was in some kind of campaign meeting or environment, and I said, you know, let's just hook it to President Obama's proposal and we'll call it Obamacare, and everybody loved it. So we decided to go with it.
So you use it, and it gets good reviews?
Yeah, I used it in a couple of speeches. I went on Sunday morning television and used it. And I think the strategy behind it was, you know, is this the time to have somebody take on Mitt and, again, start to establish yourself as the primary credible conservative alternative?
And had no one taken him on to that point?
No, it was all, you know, the early stage of the campaign is always, you know, Reagan's 11th Amendment, we don't attack each other, you know, it devolves after that. But,
It's true. It's everyone's so tepid. They don't
so in the early days, you know, everybody
gets
along.
You don't want to be that first guy.
No,
right?
No. And then the other thing is, you know, now with super PACs, you don't need to do it.
Exactly.
Because you can have your super PAC do it. But, you know, so the question was, everybody knew it was going to turn. But, you know, did you want it to turn early, later? And if so, one thing to keep in mind is you're going to attack somebody with, you know, $100 million in a super PAC. Do you have the ability to defend yourself?
Yeah, because he's going to bring a world of pain.
When the counteroffensive comes. And so that was a lot of thought went into it, but we decided it was worth launching at that point.
And why was that? Just the times demanded it, your polling numbers weren't improving, you needed to be that credible alternative?
Yes.
Okay. So you do it on the shows, and then walk us through what happened at the debate.
Well, I mean, the short version, Sam, is I just botched the answer. So,
yeah,
I mean,
but I understand that, but what's it like internally as it's happening?
Well, the actual – I've shared this publicly before, but, you know, so we're in the debate preparation. And again, I wish I would have just thrown this all off and just answered however the heck I wanted. But the consultants say, look, in every answer, you got to do three things, and you got to do them in this order. Hmm. You know, first, if it's a question from the audience, acknowledge the audience member, empathize with their concern, and personalize it to them. That's number one. Two, no, our base loves nothing better than bashing Obama. So then you got to bash Obama. And then three, make your point. and so, you know, I've got that.
And you
in
get
my
30 seconds.
And by the way, squeeze that all into 30 seconds.
And look comfortable.
And look comfortable doing that. So I'm up on the stage, and the question comes from the audience. So it's on a screen from somebody, I think a woman in New Hampshire or somewhere, who asked the healthcare question. So I start out by, you know, acknowledging her point and attempting to empathize with the perspective that she's sharing. I'm about to get into bashing Obama. And John King, who's the moderator, you know, to his credit, he's a good moderator, he starts to get impatient with the fact that I'm not answering his question.
The question, Governor, was why Obamacare?
That's right. Well, I'm going to get to that, John.
You have 30 seconds, Governor.
But I wasn't through my three-point, you know, checklist yet. So John's like, well, you know, will you use it? Will you? And so he and I get in this back and forth. I'm off my three-point, you know, checklist. And I should have just blurted out, you know, yelled into the microphone. Yes, damn it, Obamacare.
But you were stuck with the three.
And it was easy to fix. And I just got stuck in that. And frankly, had the campaign been able to last and do some more debates, I think, again, that I could have overcome that. But in that moment, especially since it was, you know, towards the end of what would be the end of my campaign, or you know, close to what would be the end of my campaign, it was an important moment. But it wasn't terminal.
No.
It's no oops. It was no oops.
It was no oops.
And we just didn't, you know, we just didn't have enough time and space.
Did you recognize as it was happening that you needed to get, that you had failed?
No, I remember I thought. The answer wasn't great, but I didn't think it was awful.
Yeah.
But I remember during a break, I was going to the bathroom or you know back to the dressing room for something during a break.
You can do that? You can get off stage?
Yeah, they have a little break.
So oh, okay.
Two or three minutes.
I thought you'd just stand there.
Yeah. It's like, you know, they got to have a commercial.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, I didn't realize.
And I remember Nick, my campaign manager, who I like a lot, was, you know, ashen, you know, standing back at one of the doors. And he's like, you know, you got to fix this. I'm like, fix what? He's like, you know, the Obamacare answer. And then it started to dawn on me that, you know, was not just – you know, bumbled a little bit, but viewed as a, you know, major problem.
And everything's happening in the moment now with social media, so it became a thing, basically.
I mean, it became a thing before the debate was even over. It became a thing, you know, within minutes. And there's, I thought, well, maybe I can go back at some point in the debate and try to fix it, but then it looks ham-fisted like you're going back for a half hour later. Or something.
It's in your closing statement. Yeah,
thanks for that question on a rant.
The other thing I have to ask you about is, you got, I don't know how to describe the reaction to you calling your wife a red-hot smoking wife.
Now, some of you, I hope not all of you, have seen this goofy movie called Talladega Nights. One of the scenes in the movie. At one point in the prayer, he says, and thank you, Lord, for my red-hot smoking wife. And I think that captures the sentiment about how I feel about the First Lady of Minnesota, Mary Plenty, who joins me, my red-hot smoking wife, Mary Plenty.
But it became like a thing. It was like, people were like, did he mean it that way? And I always thought it was, like, kind of cute. It was nice of you. But obviously, in the context of a campaign, it was like people were almost, like, appalled by it.
Oh, it was just an attempt to be humorous and a little cute. And it's something I had done, you know, for years. So this dates back to being governor, maybe even in the legislature. So, you know, my wife and I are and part of it is gauging how she feels about it. And at least early on, she liked it. And it's a stolen line from, you know, Talladega Nights and Will Ferrell and
Ricky Bobby.
Legend of Ricky Bobby. So it's all meant to be tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
And she kind of liked it, and it was funny. At least in Minnesota, it was funny. But I think some people in the social media sphere just didn't know what to make of it. Is he being serious? Is he being, you know, a clown? Is he, you know, is he being disrespectful? Is he, what is this?
But that seemed to like symbolize for me another really irritating part of the campaign, which is any humanizing element that a candidate exhibits becomes interpreted through different lenses. Or misinterpreted in different
lenses. Well, George Bush said something to me once when he was running against, I guess it was John Kerry. I was on a campaign bus with him in Minnesota. And he said, look, if you haven't done this before, been really close to it, this thing is a gauntlet, the length of which, the intensity of which, you just can't fathom until you've done it.
Yeah.
And the amount of daily, hourly, now minute by minute concentration that this takes is enormous. And he posited, and I'm paraphrasing here, that Kerry was going to, you know, break underneath that. And he did.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What was the most quintessentially Iowa experience you had?
The state fair, of course. Yeah. You know, go to the Iowa State Fair. But, you know, the thing about Iowa that is a little understated is there's, you know, there's a commercialization of politics down there. And if you unwrap the package a little deeper, you'll see that a lot of the people who are, you know, active politically are also commercialize the experience. And so they're looking for jobs, for consulting gigs, for, you know, some sort of service provider contract and the like. And so there's a whole what I'd call milieu of political industry in Iowa that I had no idea even existed.
So it's not as like homespun. Oh, I just got to meet you and look you in the eye and shake your hand, and then
you
that'll
got,
be
you got to feed the.
There's some of that, but there's a bunch of what I'd call political leaders in Iowa who view the presidential election cycle as a commercial opportunity. Yeah. I don't think it's quid, you know, it's certainly not quid pro quo. I'm just saying that, you know, the press reports, well, so and so's campaign got this big name, you know, Republican activist. Well, the big name Republican activist joined the campaign because they got hired.
Exactly. You know,
right.
Yeah, get me some.
It's like, well, that's here. Amazing how that works.
As you were going through Iowa, and then you did, I mean, you got in there early, and then when we talked about it, these other candidates kept coming in and having their time in the polls, that it felt like 2 weeks, and then they would flame back down. But what were your staff saying? Were like, okay, just wait your time, and you'll get your run.
No, you know, I remember one. There was one important staff meeting or, you know, campaign meeting where we became clear that Michelle Bachmann was going to get in the race. And one person alone who was sort of to call not the most outspoken or even senior staff member kind of at the very end said, do you think we should revisit our straw poll strategy and commitment to it and this amount of dedication of resources to it? Because, you know, knowing what we know about her and the caucuses, it seems like that's just perfectly lined up for her.
Yeah.
And, you know, wouldn't be better off to kind of let that run its course a little bit so everybody can get a full view of her campaign and our campaign? And everybody kind of instantly poo-pooed it. No, you know, we're too far into it. And you can't back out, you know, tone back or scale back now for blah, blah, blah. And I think that turned out to be a good question and something that I think we would have been well served to just say, hey, look, most of the major campaigns aren't participating, you know, in light of Michelle Bachmann's coming into the race. We're just going to step back, still participate, but just not push.
Well, she gave you the excuse at that point to back out, which is kind of what you needed in a way.
And I don't, and I think we still would have participated, but I think we would just take our lumps and finish second or third and then continue to plow on. Again, there's so many straw polls now, and they come so fast and furiously. And the Iowa straw poll, even by the press, has been so, you know, better understood and contextualized that literally a week later, nobody cared.
Why make it the big thing? Why make it that important? Why is that important?
Well, I think, again, under our theory of the case, which was Mitt's going to break out, we got to look for some early opportunity to be identified as the primary conservative alternative before he breaks away. We viewed that as the opportunity to do that. Plus, you know, a neighboring state governor, Midwestern governor, how do you explain not either participating or not doing well in the straw poll? So for all those reasons, we kind of looked to that as a – and we thought we could win it or at least do really well. We looked to that as an opportunity. It turns out, as you know, the straw poll isn't a good predictor of anything. It's not a good predictor of who's going to win the caucuses. It's not a good predictor who's going to win the nomination. It's not a good predictor who's going to win the presidency. And the – methodology around it is, you know, highly suspect.
Presumably you knew that going in though, right?
We did.
So what was your strategy about how to win it?
Well, our strategy to how to win it was to out-organize everybody and, you know, make sure we had a good grassroots effort in Iowa, which we did. But I think Michelle became, you know, given the nature of the straw poll and who shows up and why they show up and the like, I think she had even a bigger claim to that audience than we did. No, well, I think you know, Congresswoman Bachmann, you know, was certainly viewed by some as a fringe person, but I saw her in Minnesota as a pretty effective grassroots organizer, and you know, she's somebody who captured, at least at the party level or the grassroots level, a lot of followers. So I was under no delusion that she wouldn't be an effective both media person, but also, you know, grassroots organizer and at that level. What I also believe, though, is that, you know, she probably wasn't going to be the nominee. But that, again, the price of finding that out is you got to have enough resources to stick around.
Well, give us a sense of the scale of the investment that you actually made. What are we talking about?
Oh, between the PAC and the campaign, you know, it couldn't have been more than $6 or $7 million. But again, we were out of the race.
That's
by
it.
August.
Just six. Just
yeah, yeah. And I'm just guessing. So I think
all on the straw poll.
Yeah.
When did you know you were going to lose?
I knew I was going to lose when I went to look at Michelle Bachmann's tent. Actually, I was brought over to look at a wind turbine. So this was one of the giant, you know, wind power mm-hmm. turbines. And the line to get into Michelle Bachmann's tent at the Iowa Straw Poll was, like, you know, wrapped three times around the building. And she had Randy Travis. So,
shit. She pulled the Travis card.
Yeah, the Travis card. But, you know, it was pretty clear just based on the amount of people streaming in and out of her tent and what that meant for the straw poll results that was, but on that day. So we had some hopes, high hopes coming in. I don't think we needed to win it. I think if you would have been roughly clumped. Or if Ron Paul just won it outright, mm-hmm. you know, people would say, well, that's Ron Paul. But we came in third.
Yeah, and that was devastating.
It seemed devastating at the time,
yeah.
But that isn't why we got out of the race. I got out of the race because we were out of money.
After the straw poll, when did you make the decision to drop out? I forgot. Was it like the
that
next day?
That night. Yeah. Announced it the next morning. My wife and I went up to a town north of Ames. I forget the name of it. And we went to a Mexican restaurant and had margaritas and Mexican food.
What was
how many margaritas?
Yeah. One big one, I think.
Yeah. What did
it was
you,
the size of a fish.
Yeah, exactly.
No.
It had a fish. Take us to the restaurant and what did you guys? How did you hash it out?
Well, it evolved a little more incrementally than that, because one of the concerns I had leading up to this was, you know, how are we really doing financially as a campaign, and regardless of the outcome of the straw poll, where are we going to be? And that week leading up to the straw poll, I learned, you know, incrementally that we were in – there was more concern in that regard than I thought. And I think it was on the eve of the straw poll that the team said, look, you know, you get out soon, we can avoid being in debt. But if you continue on much after this, you know, our run rate, our burn rate on salary and overhead and all this stuff, you know, unless you raise this, we're going to be this far in the hole. And then it dawned on me right as the straw poll was coming up and on the day that, you know, we got a financial problem. And so the main reason for trying to bring the campaign to a head in that moment was to avoid what I'd call a McCain-esque financial problem. And ours wasn't at the same level because we had a much smaller campaign. But, you know, the alternative was to dramatically scale back the campaign and then go live off the land, as they call it, and try to forge ahead.
Did you talk to McCain about this? I mean, I presumed he would have because...
No, it happened pretty quickly. I mean, from the time I realized the magnitude of the problem to the time we got out of the race was less than a week, and I was busy, you know, during the ramp-up to the straw poll.
And did you give any serious consideration to doing what he did, which is essentially flying coach with one person?
You know, we thought about that. I actually like that idea, and I think for me in particular that would have been appealing because, you know, driving around Iowa in a pickup truck with one other person might have been fun. But there was a lot of – having watched campaigns that go into debt and for years and years and years can never get out, and there's some people who ran for president last year still in
Newt.
Debt.
Newt.
Yeah. Still in debt. And it's really difficult to pay off those campaign debts after the campaign's over. So I had a window of time, a moment of time to – make the decision and maintain kind of financial sanity around it. And that's the primary, you know, almost the exclusive reason I made the decision to get out of the race at the time.
You know, I was fascinated by the idea that when you look at sort of every box you're supposed to check, right? You know, you hired the right campaign manager. Everyone wanted Nick Ayers. You got in fairly early. You had that record. You were, you know, the blue collar conservative governor. So you had this ideal perception of what a candidate should be, and yet it wasn't clicking.
thing that I think ultimately was our undoing, and this is all retrospective, sure, is we didn't have the money to stay in long enough to get a full and fair hearing, I don't think. So, you know, if you look at the race, our premise was Mitt Romney was going to be so well-financed and the rest of the field so limited that he was going to break away from the pack early and never look back over his shoulder. And if we didn't take our very limited resources and make some progress early as the main, you know, viable, credible, conservative alternative to Mitt, you know, he was going to be gone and leave everybody else in the rearview mirror and it would be over by Iowa or New Hampshire. That didn't happen, but that was our premise.
Yeah.
And so we put down a disproportionate amount of our limited resources early on the Iowa straw poll. And frankly, a week later, nobody cared about the Iowa straw poll. And it was really a false setup in the sense that, you know, once Michelle Bachmann got in the race late, knowing what we knew about her, knowing what we know about the Iowa straw poll, I think we would have been better served to pull down some of our activities except a second or third place hit in that straw poll and live to fight another day, because for each month there was a flavor of the month. I mean, believe it or not, Herman Cain was leading for a month.
Yeah.
Michelle Bachmann was leading
for a month. I remember the moment where we had to decide whether to cover him.
Bachmann's leading for a month. Yeah. Newt's leading for a month. Santorum's leading for a month. And the campaign turned out to be much more elongated
than
we anticipated. And the other thing I underestimated was just how much money it takes to hang in there. So I think to get anti-money to be credible for four or five states, you need $50 million. And the other thing we missed is the advent of the super PAC. I remember Mitt coming to see me at the governor's residence in Minnesota, and I was still governor, and he was thinking about running. I was at least thinking about running. We shared our views, and we were friends and got along, you know, well. And he said, Timmy, have you thought about or heard about, you know, these, in the wake of this court decision, this thing called a super PAC?
Been changed perhaps forever by the U.S. Supreme Court. In these GOP primaries, we are seeing almost unlimited amounts of money, almost all of it spent on attack ads, the air war, almost all of it spent by these so-called super PACs.
I remember laughing afterwards with some of my staff and team and consultants. I'd say, yeah, I need a super PAC too. Like, you know, I didn't even know what it was. I'm like,
sounds cool, though.
I'm like, yeah, I went back and kind of like jokingly said, yeah, I need a super PAC too. Let's all get a super PAC, you know, blah, a super PAC. But it turned out, you know, he and others saw the significance of that court decision. And again, appropriately, and not with his orchestrating, and presumably a bunch of his friends who were able to do it, both financially and politically, put it together. And then Newt was kept alive in part, you know, by one large super PAC donor. And Santorum was kept alive in part by one large super PAC donor. And I didn't even know what it was. I mean, until we were well into the race. And I remember thinking, damn, I wish we would have had a super PAC.
But it doesn't, that's the thing, though. That's the beauty of the super PAC. It doesn't take that much to get it going.
You could just need one.
Yeah, you just need one guy. Sets up a 501c4.
But a billionaire is willing to, you know, write a pretty big check.
That was Tim Pawlenty, former Minnesota governor and presidential candidate in 2012, who joined us here in the studio on Candidate Confessional. It was a good conversation. Next week, we are joined with a special guest, former RNC chairman and Maryland Senate candidate Michael Steele.
For a really, really deep conversational race. It's good. It's a great one.
Very good conversation. And, of course, a big thanks to Christine Canetta, our fearless editor, for putting this all together.
As always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or check us out at HuffingtonPost.com.
Please join us next week, and happy trails.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.